Welcome to a new edition of The Brand Called You. Today I have a really, really senior professional from the pharmaceutical industry, Rajeev Gulati. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ashutosh. Glad to be here.
Rajeev was the president of Ranbaxy for the global head of anti-counterfeiting. He has worked for several companies. He's an M-Pharm and he's from IIM Ahmedabad. So Rajeev, tell me a little bit about your early professional career.
Can I start even before that, Ashutosh?
Okay.
So, let me start the story when I was 16 years of age. I was a first year student at Delhi University and I volunteered for a pharmaceutical conference.
Okay.
And Dr. Parvinder Singh was the president of the Delhi chapter of the Pharmaceutical Association. And I can tell you one thing, I met with him and I was bowled over.
Mm-hmm.
What a personality he was. So, he was running Ranbaxy and Ranbaxy was total global turnover was 2 crores per annum, a small company. And I said, hey, I wish I can work with him. So as luck would have it, after my MBA from IIM Ahmedabad, I was recruited from campus by Ranbaxy.
Wow.
So I did start my career with Dr. Parvinder Singh.
Okay.
as I dreamed to.
Uh-huh.
And so early days was quite an experience, both positive and kind of disillusionment.
Correct.
When you're a student, you have this imagination of how professional a company would be. And I thought I would join Ranbaxy and they would have PhD in economics, predicting how the rural healthcare is growing, how the urban is growing, which therapeutic areas. The reality is not like
Correct.
That. Reality is the business is far more opportunistic.
Yes. Yes.
Molecules which you can copy and which you can launch. So that was the one part. But the other part was Dr. Singh. I have been to 35 countries and I have not seen a visionary like him in my life. The story of India, the Indian industry globalizing or becoming the multinational companies of India, I think the vision was given by Dr. Singh. And Ranbaxy was the first true multinational of Indian origin in any industry.
Yes.
So that was, those were the heady days. So off and on for 10 years, I was with Ranbaxy and Mr. Brar was my boss. He is still my friend, my guru, my mentor. So those were the heady days. Ranbaxy was the fastest growing company, globalizing, though I was part of domestic business.
Mm.
So I got the opportunity to long brands like Revachal and Sifron. I mean, those are big brands even for Sun Pharma today and known all over India. So after the first disillusionment, I would think I was totally immersed and it was a vision of Dr. Singh and the implementation of Mr. Brar, which inspired me and together we did some great stuff.
Wonderful. And then you moved to Eli Lilly.
Then I moved to Eli Lilly and spent 19 years with Eli Lilly, yes.
And this was in India and overseas?
This was in India and overseas. I was the first employee when Lilly came to India.
Okay.
So I started the company for them. So that was an outstanding experience, you know. The MD came from the US, I was from India, two of us on a broken table. And none of us had started a company before.
Correct.
So two of us on a broken table. That's how I start my story.
Wonderful.
We were sitting in a room with a table, center table, which had a big crack in it.
Mm-hmm.
So two of us on a broken table and we started a company, which for 15 years remained fastest growing pharmaceutical company in India.
Wow.
I went to the US after the first 3 years. Then I came back as managing director. Then I became chairman of the company as well. And then went back and settled down with Lilly forever.
Okay. Very interesting. So before I moved into some more questions of the pharmaceutical industry, what would be some of your learnings from your corporate career?
Oh my God, learnings, too many learnings. See, I'm not a scientist.
Correct.
And I'm not a coder or an IT professional. So since I'm a business person, I work with people. So all the learnings is how to deal with people, how to work with people. I had people reporting to me from a very early age. And I think my real learning how to manage people came when I became a father myself.
Okay.
And the patience that you need for your own children and the care you need for your own children. My theory is that it's the same way you need to work with your subordinates. So you can, I have another theory that you can fool your boss, but you can never fool your subordinates. They know whether you have their interest at heart, whether you are looking after their career, or are you taking credit for their work. So, so Ranbaxy was more the drive and the passion. But when I came to Lilly, it's all about people, people and people, because a very, very strong people culture. And I think I got a rebirth when I switched from Ranbaxy, where I learned the drive and the passion, and then from to Lilly, where I really learned how to deal with people, whether they report to you or they don't report to you, the teamwork, the respect for the individuals. Everybody is unique, everybody is different. And how do you deal with them? I think those were the huge learnings in my in my early career.
Very interesting. Thank you. So, you know, Rajeev, you're one of the tallest leaders of the pharmaceutical industry today. So I want to ask you a few questions on the pharmaceutical industry. You know, the industry is booming. And we all know, you know, Indian pharmaceutical industry is really growing fast. But from your perspective, what are some of the challenges the industry is facing?
In fact, this industry used to be called recession-proof. Because people would fall sick and they would need medicines. And for chronic medicines, you have to take medicine for your blood pressure with diabetes, come what may. But of late, industry has failed some headwinds. It's not as rosy. So let me talk about those challenges. Ranbaxy discovered America. I firmly believe that. That Ranbaxy was the one that figured out that exporting to the developed world, because those are far bigger markets than India. India is today the third largest in terms of volume, but it is 12th in terms of value. So therefore, you go where the dollars are. The number one is the United States. So, as I mentioned earlier, that everybody learned from Dr. Singh or from Ranbaxy. So everybody discovered America. Today, 40% of generics consumed in the United States are of Indian origin. India is the pharmacy to the world and the largest exporter. The downside is that everybody learned the game and Indian companies are competing with Indian companies. I'll give you a small example. When I joined Ranbaxy as president in 2011, I said, let me understand the business first. So in US, I said, I want five different P&Ls. In Europe, I split East and West Europe. The minute I did that, I found that you don't make money in developed countries today. So there's a lot of money to be spent in research and development, in filings, in getting approvals. You have to make three batches, 6 months stability, filing GDUFA fee, and then you get approval to launch in the United States. And then you find, you know, there are 27 other Indian companies that got approval the same day as you did. So it's more like a commodity. It's extremely difficult today. And the hurdles to launch have been increasing constantly. And all of us know about the challenges with the FDA of the United States. So the expectation of FDA have been rising. The regulatory hurdles have been rising globally. So the cost of launching has been rising, but the reward has been shrinking. That is as far as the developed countries are concerned. There's still to be money to be made in developing countries because those are branded businesses. But Western Europe, USA, Canada, Japan, India is not cracked yet. Australia, they're unbranded. And therefore, there is nothing to be to differentiate from one company to another. So the competition is intense. And that's hurt many companies quite a lot. And the other is India. Of course, the government is very keen to reduce cost of healthcare. The price control, the reduction in prices of stents and knee replacement is an indicator of the direction in which government is moving. Then other thing that Prime Minister Modi has talked about, and this budget also, this was discussed on 1st of February, is about Jan Aushadhi. So government is keen that India should move towards generics, just like the developed countries. And if that happens, that will be a big challenge for the industry, because that will bring the cost of healthcare down, but will impact the profitability of the industry. So these are a couple of challenges that the industry is facing.
So, you know, you also worked on counterfeiting.
Anti-counterfeiting.
You worked on anti-counterfeiting. and we also know that a very, very large amount of Indian pharma has an issue of counterfeit medicines. And by counterfeit, it could be fake or underpowered, if I can use that.
Yes.
What would be your perspective on anti-counterfeiting and what can be done about it?
See, of course, I can talk from the global perspective and the US perspective, but I think you want to talk more about...
No, let's talk both.
Okay. So,
I'd love to get your perspective.
So when I became global head of anti-counterfeiting, there were two companies that were focusing on it. It was Pfizer and Lilly. Mm-hmm. And the focus was on security agencies, in investigation, identifying the plants that were making counterfeits, and working with the governments all over the world and closing those plants. I very soon figured out one thing, and I think that changed the complexion of the work that we all did. First thing I figured out is that in India, the counterfeits are sold through brick and mortar
stores.
Yeah. Whereas in developed countries, they are sold online. Whereas CVS, Walgreens, Walmart are very safe, are very regulated. So the strategy that you needed to fight counterfeits in the developed countries were entirely different. So what was happening is that they would find a fake website and they would send notices, and one out of 100 website would close. I funded and started an association called Alliance for Safe Online Pharmacies and brought in a law firm and created an organization where National Association of Board of Pharmacies, the Pharmacists Association, the industry, the FDA, and everybody participated. So what we did is we hired a consultant who was ex-federal government in the United States. His name is John Horton. And he developed an algorithm where we were able to find the fake websites much faster. And we started. Then he, since he had a legal mind, he found that while the domain holding was given to GoDaddy's and others, there was a clause there that you would not allow domain registration for illegal activities.
Okay.
So it was very difficult to ask the websites to close down because most of them had servers in Russia. Yeah. They would give address of or the name of Canada and the medicines would go from India and China. So very difficult to close down. But then we would go to these domain holders and say, you can't allow illegal activities, and our algorithm shows us these domains are illegal. So we started closing them by the hundreds.
Okay.
So that was one which really helped a lot.
Yeah.
And then we created a chapter in India as well, which is still continuing, which is called Partnership for Safe Medicines, India. But India, the challenges are different. India is very porous. We have 800,000 independent mom and pop stores, chemists, and more than 100,000 retail, and then sub-wholesalers. And we all know that a lot of shops don't even have pharmacists.
Yeah.
It's easy to get a license. Whereas the US, you know, it's pharmacist has to be there, and they are chain stores, they are all computerized. So what we did that, I'm General Secretary of the Association of E-Pharmacies. Mm-hmm. So I have been dealing with government quite a lot. In fact, I met the previous Joint Secretary of Health 14 times in 12 months.
Wow.
And the entire discussion was that how to regulate the distribution, both online and offline. Mm-hmm. So we had developed a full program for the government where every retailer would have to record the purchases and the sale of each strip and record the batch number and the expiration date into central database by using just a mobile phone.
Correct.
And we said the industry, even e-pharmacies, are happy to fund creation of this database which could electronically control. For example, if a company has produced 300,000 tablets of a particular batch, and if wholesaler or retailer is selling more than that of that particular batch, then you know the counterfeits have gotten in. Or if there is a batch which doesn't exist, it's a counterfeit.
Correct.
Immediately it would be caught. So government liked it, but then of course retailers opposed it. And retailers have a very, very strong lobby association called AIOCD.
Yeah.
So nothing's happened.
Okay.
But unless you have a track and trace from end to end, from the manufacturer till the end customer, you know, we can't get rid of this virus.
Correct. Very true. So Rajiv, let's talk a little bit about e-pharmacies.
Sure.
You know, and at one stage you were also an investor in
of course, chemistry. Yeah. We'll I was the founder of an e-pharmacy.
Correct. My first question to you is, in the e-pharmacies, and a lot of people have asked me this question because of my background as a brick and mortar
player. Right, absolutely.
Is that how are these companies offering 20 to 25% discount when the margins are so low?
See, in theory, the way it is supposed to work is that you have economies of scale.
Yeah.
You have purchasing power. There is a tripartite agreement among retailers, industry, and the government, where in the branded formulation, a retailer gets 20% margin and a wholesaler gets 10%. That's the maximum. But the fact remains, when the hospitals that buy in bulk, they're able to get up to 35%.
Which is the institutional buyer.
And if the size and scale of the e-pharmacies grows, then many of them have started buying directly from the companies, or the retailers they work with, they've enabled them to buy directly from the companies. And at least 28-29% margin they are able to get.
Okay.
And of course, they would like to get more and more discount from the manufacturers and pass on more and more to the customers.
Yeah. And I guess this industry, not only does it have institutional buyer discounts, which are really for hospitals, but it also has schemes.
There are bonus schemes many companies come up with. And
those can be very attractive.
And if you're buying directly from the company, you get the advantage of that. Correct. And you are able to pass that on to the customers.
Correct. So, given the fact that we've got 800,000 stores, retail stores, we've got half a dozen e-pharmacy companies, do you see them coexisting? Or do you see e-pharmacies at some stage getting much, much more closer to the customer?
They will coexist, as they coexist in all the countries, all over the world. E-pharmacies will make money and can make money only on chronic medicines.
Correct.
Because once you register, then you have to buy medicine every month, anti-diabetics or antihypertensives or cholesterol medicines. It's very expensive to create new registrations. So holding the customer is critical. So acute medicines, a person buys an antibiotic once, uses it for 5 days, is cured. And then if he gets infection again, then he's a new customer and a different antibiotic. So, and plus you need painkillers and antibiotics, the acute medicines, immediately. And I don't think e-pharmacies will ever reach a situation where they can supply the medicines in half an hour or 2 hours.
Correct.
So therefore, acute medicines will always continue to be with brick and mortar. And in the United States, for example, the precursor of e-pharmacies are the mail order pharmacy. It's a huge business. I mean, that Express Scripts and Caremark are more than $100 billion. So insurance companies mandate that your cholesterol medicines you will get at home after 1 week, and you will get 3 months medicines at a stretch because they are paying for it.
Yeah.
And if you go to buy a brick and mortar pharmacy to a CVS or a Walgreens, then there's a huge copay.
Correct.
So there's an incentive for customers to buy online. But if you have infection or if you have pain, then doctor can call the pharmacy.
Correct.
And insurance companies will reimburse and you have to buy from brick and mortar pharmacy because you can't wait for a week.
Yeah.
So they do coexist all over the world and they will continue to coexist in India as well.
Okay. Very interesting. So one question to you about startups and entrepreneurship. And I know after such a successful corporate career, you did become an entrepreneur.
As reduced.
As did I. And you at least were in that space. I wasn't. But
Yes. With my domain, you worked in an entirely different
space.
Completely
different domain, you know. But my questions are more generic, if I can use that term again. The first question is that, is it good to go as an entrepreneur solo, or is it good to have a co-founder?
I think it's good to have a co-founder.
Okay.
You can have complementary strengths. Mm-hmm. For example, somebody can bring accounting, finance, kind of a numbers skill.
Correct.
And somebody can bring a people skill. somebody can look after inside the organization, whether it is office or whether you have a plant or whether you have a research, and somebody can bring customers from outside. So you do need, and it's very difficult for one person, and as a startup, you know, you don't have money to recruit brilliant employees. Yes. And you need good employees, and you have to pay them well. But you can't recruit a COO or CEO right up front.
Correct.
So if more than one founder, two or three or four, you'll see a lot of startups and multiple founders. Yeah. We look at Flipkart, for example, or look at any other.
Absolutely.
They had at least two founders who brought complementary strengths and created startups.
So my next question on startups to you would be that, you know, you have had a startup, and I'm sure you're investing in startups. You advise startups. What are some of the basic mistakes a lot of startup entrepreneurs make?
You see, the success of Flipkart and that they sold to Walmart.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks this is easy money.
Correct.
So most of the startups, in my mind, are not well thought out. You have to have a plan in mind. You have to look at the environment, and you have to look at it 5 to 10 years. Many startups I've seen, not all, but many startups I've seen, they say, I'll have a startup and I'll get money. But to get money, after all, the investor is not foolish.
Yep.
Investor would evaluate. So I think one of the first thing you need to do is put yourself in the investor's shoes and say, what is investors is looking at, or what is he going to look at, and am I able to provide that? For example, have I understood the environment? Have I looked at the competition? The most important thing is, what I'm doing, is it unique? Is it different? Is it difficult to copy?
Correct.
Because moat is one thing every investor would look at. If what you are doing is 100 other people are doing, then there is no moat, and nobody will invest in you.
Yeah.
So I think many startups are not very well thought through, and they don't have a long-term strategy in place, because you have to be prepared to be there for at least 10 years. Mm-hmm. Because investors would come in, they would exit after 4 or 5 years, and the next investor would want to look at the next 5 years, how you're going to grow.
Yeah.
And the biggest challenge I think most startups do, and this has been written about as well, is challenge of scaling.
Correct.
A small startup is different from a large company.
Absolutely.
And that's why I say you have to think through for the next 10 years that not only what is different and what is unique about me, but also that how am I going to scale up and become big? Because personally, I've worked in large companies, so I can't think of a small startup doing few crores per annum. I mean, that's not a startup.
Yeah.
That's a, you know, lale ki dukaan. You can anybody can do it. But you have to have that vision.
Correct.
And then you have to have think through not only this strategy in the beginning, but also how to scale up. Scaling up is the biggest challenge,
right?
Because you need far more money, and then that's where the restructuring and the people you have recruited in the beginning may not be suitable for different jobs. You may need to bring people from outside, then there has to be a cultural fit. So those are the challenges people sometimes don't think through.
Very interesting. So Rajiv, just a few more questions, and these are a few questions to you personally. My first question, and I think you answered it right in the beginning, is that, have you had people who've had a strong influence in you? And if yes, what have you learned from them? I know you've spoken to about Dr. Pukhari.
Yes, I talked about two individuals, Dr. Singh and Mr. Brar. Right. Mr. Brar was the operational head of Ranbaxy at that time. And whereas Dr. Singh taught us vision, Mr. Brar taught us execution. And that was critical. And it was an excellent combination.
Yeah.
That's why the company grew so well. I would like to name one more person. His name is Andrew Mascarenhas, and he and I started Lily together.
Yeah, on the broken desk.
Two of us and the broken table. Yes, exactly. He was the person.
Yeah.
So Andrew was the one who, you know, when we started, we had the first group of individuals whom we recruited, and said, Andrew, you are the managing director. And I was number two in the company as director of sales and marketing. And so you address them. And Andrew talked about values. What holds a company together. And that had a tremendous impact on me and the organization as well. You talk to any ex-Lily employee today,
they talk about values.
They will talk about values. And the first value was respect for the individual.
Correct.
So those were the some things which have been, I hold very dear in my life, and Andrew had a lot of influence on me, my thinking and my behavior.
Wonderful. So my next question is, what would be three words that define Rajiv?
Three words?
Three adjectives.
Compassionate, patient, and to some extent, I would say strategic.
Wonderful. Very good. Very, very good. So Rajiv, next question is relating to failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask this from all my guests, mm-hmm. because I've often said that in India, particularly Asia in general, we don't teach children that it's okay to fail. It's always first, right in front, ahead of everybody else, etc. And yet we all fail. What have been some of your learnings from some of your mistakes or your failures?
Well, I can talk about a couple of failures. One was when Renbaxy wanted to start an OTC business along with the prescription business. I started that and we failed miserably. I think I personally was more in a brand manager's mindset and not a complete business mindset. And I grossly underestimated the importance of distribution.
Correct.
We created a brand and we were trying to advertise. But the availability at the store is critical.
Correct.
If the person wants a product and it's not available, he's not going to go again and try again and again.
True.
So, when the second startup in which I invested, I made sure that the first focus is on availability and distribution and the point of sales. I mean, it's a very simple thing, but I made a mistake.
I agree.
Second was that the M-Chemist. It was one of the first e-pharmacies. In fact, it was the second e-pharmacy. Mm. M1MG was first and we were second. And NetMeds came around the same time. I had the right vision, but the wrong execution. It's a very thin margin business.
Yeah.
You yourself asked me about discounting. So most of the margin you're getting, you're passing on.
Correct.
So very, very thin margin. So the volume has to be enormous.
True.
So from day one, you have to think of a large company and not that I'll have a small startup and then grow later. And from day one, you have to have access to resources and the money to create a big company. And we didn't do that. In the second one, I think again, both the learnings were useful. We knew how to start and we knew how to scale up and we got funding also. So that's been working much better. Okay. One lives and learns.
Wonderful, I agree. Rajiv, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Always nice to be with you, Ashutosh.
And relearning so much about the pharma business.
Thanks a lot, Ashutosh.
Thanks
for having me here.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.